This is David Barsamian, recorded by Alex Smith in Vancouver on April 15th, 2012.
Thank you very much for coming. South Asian Network for Secularism and Democracy is an organization of the South Asian diaspora in the lower mainland of British Columbia, mainly, though we have some people elsewhere in Canada and outside Canada as well. Our purpose is to promote the cause of genuine democracy and genuine secularism, tied as these concepts are to the maintenance of human rights, to the defense of human rights, to the defense of social justice, and to the cause of peace. Now, David is somebody whom many of you know so well that my introduction will be completely redundant, but some of you may need a little introduction, so I will be very brief in introducing David. David is the founder, director of Alternative Radio, the independent weekly audio series based in Boulder, Colorado, a nationally syndicated program carried by 125 radio stations. His work has helped change the media landscape in North America. He has interviewed and authored books with Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Iqbal Ahmed, Tariq Ali, Arundhati Roy, and Edward Said. His best-selling books with Chomsky have been translated into many languages. His latest books are How the World Works with Noam Chomsky and Occupy the Economy by Richard Wolff. David's interviews and articles appear in the Progressive, Zed, The Sun, and other publications. Barsamian is the winner of the Media Education Award, the ACLU's Upton Sinclair Award for Independent Journalism, and the Cultural Freedom Fellowship from the Lannan Foundation. The Institute for Alternative Journalism named him one of its top 10 media heroes. Barsamian, who had visited India many times over the last 40 years to report on the conditions there, learning Urdu and playing sitar, was deported on arrival at Indira Gandhi Airport in New Delhi last September 2023. And prevented from carrying out the interviews that he had scheduled in regard to the thousands of recently discovered unmarked graves in Kashmir. And also interviews with Dr. Binayak Sen, a medical doctor who had been held in prison for the alleged crime of being a Maoist sympathizer, because he had rendered medical assistance to insurgents who were operating in the tribal areas of India. Without much more, I'm going to invite David to take a glass of water.
Yes. Thank you very much, Chinmoy. Khushamadid, swagatam, harametsek. Wonderful to be in Vancouver again. Thank you so much for turning out on this Sunday afternoon. I've also been told by the Sunset authorities here not to mention the Canucks or the fact that they're down 2-0. I understand it's a very sensitive topic, and I will avoid it. And I want to thank Vancouver, specifically Adbusters, for being in a tangential way, the instigator for the Occupy movement in the United States, which began on Wall Street on September 17th. In an editorial in the magazine published here, there was a suggestion made people should occupy Wall Street. So I want to say, you know, chapeau bas, hats off to Cal Lawson and to the magazine. I just had a very sobering and sad experience. I suspect all of you as residents of you know, one of Canada's and one of North America's largest and most important cities have also had this experience. I just spent some time in the east end of town. And there, literally scores, hundreds of people were lining the street corners to get food, to get some kind of sustenance. It was very sobering and disturbing to see that kind of scene, which I have to tell you, I just saw in the richest city in the richest country in the world. I was in New York 3 weeks ago, walking on Madison Avenue, which is like the most, one of the most prestigious avenues in New York, you know, very high-scale shops. And in almost every doorway, people were sleeping. This is in the world's second largest democracy, India, of course, being the world's largest democracy. And I think it speaks to something about, to an economic system that is unable, and a political system that is unable to address the issues of poverty and hunger in two of the world's richest societies. Societies, for example, in Canada, and also known as Harperstan, where you have a very distinguished prime minister currently in Colombia, pontificating there, who is also considering buying large numbers of F-35 jets from the United States, while his constituency, his parts of his constituency and his citizenry in this very city are going hungry. We see those kinds of contradictions in the United States all the time with gold-plated weapon systems, aircraft carrier battle groups, nuclear weapons, nuclear submarines, and on and on. The paradoxes here of capitalism and democracy and the role that the media play in manufacturing consent are all intersected. I was in Santa Fe earlier this week. I've been traveling almost nonstop now for the last 2 or 3 weeks, so I have to, like, you know, dial in. Okay, I'm in Vancouver today. I was in Santa Fe on Monday and Tuesday, and I picked up this flyer, "No Attack on Iran." Now, you may know that once again the drumbeats of war to attack Iran, either from Israel or the United States or both, have again heated up. This seems to be a periodic kind of spasm of the imperial bellicose states to attack Iran, to threaten war. Iran is like a piñata for particularly for the power elite in Washington, D.C. They're a very easy target. They have, a president who makes the most, infelicious remarks and opens himself to enormous criticism, some of it justified. It's curious that many of the same voices in the world's second largest democracy, media voices as well as political voices, were the same ones who were telling us in 2001, 2002, 2003 that Iraq was a great threat to the United States and to the people of the world, and that it had to be eliminated. So with no sense of shame or irony, these very same voices are again appearing in the corporate control media in the United States. People like William Crystal, for example, Kenneth Pollack of the Brookings Institution. The Wall Street Journal editorial page and op-ed page is almost nonstop war talk about Iran and the danger it poses to the so-called free world. And of course, we have Goebbels TV in the United States, also known as Fox. I don't know if you have the opportunity to see Fox here in Canada, but if you do, I wish they would have a scroll on the bottom, you know, like the same kind of warnings you get about cigarettes. If you watch this TV program, it is dangerous to your health. It could cause migraines, cancer, tumors, all kinds of health problems, and you'll get very depressed in addition to absorbing a lot of negative propaganda. Now, geography, I don't know if it's taught in Canada. When I was a kid 50 years ago, it was taught in U.S. schools. Now it's largely forgotten, like spelling and the use of adverbs and other niceties of the English language. Geography is still something important to know. And if you just happen to look at a map of Iran, it's very instructive. The country is virtually surrounded by U.S. military bases and Israeli bases. If recent reports about Israel and Azerbaijan striking a military deal where Israeli Air Force planes can be situated in Azerbaijan just next to Iran. The U.S. has an enormous fleet of warships in the Persian Gulf, as well as the Mediterranean, these two bodies of water. You know, the U.S. has five Great Lakes. I say that, well, the U.S. should have seven Great Lakes because it's controlling the Mediterranean and the Persian Gulf as well. And neighboring Iran is Afghanistan and Turkey, where the U.S. also has major Air Force bases. So if Iran is, as we would say, is in kind of a pickle, not exactly in a exemplary geographical position, not to mention military position, it's quite weak militarily, and it certainly has no nuclear weapons, as is being accused of developing, unlike two states which are threatening it, Israel and the United States. Now, Israel is not a signatory to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. It also has the virtue of being a very close ally of the United States. And what does that mean? Well, that you get special benefits when you're a close ally of the United States. You're exempt from international law, the UN Charter, and just common sense and decency does not apply. The same thing with India, by the way, not a signatory to the IAEA. Nevertheless, it has an arsenal of nukes, and so does neighboring Pakistan. In the media propaganda that is now in full kind of display, it's pretty hard to miss, Iran is accused of meddling in Afghanistan. Iran is accused of meddling, interfering in Iraq. What adjectives would you conjure up to describe a U.S. military intervention in those countries and constant drone surveillance of those countries? Is that a form of interference and meddling in the internal affairs of other countries? Of course it is. But again, with a very well-disciplined media in the world's second largest democracy, these kinds of contradictions are not highlighted. They're not illuminated. And I think they should be. The best newspaper in the United States is the New York Times. It has had a series of front page articles about Iran and the, you know, this growing threat that we should all be trembling in our seats, you know, every time you hear the word about the word Iran. In Din over Iran, rattling sabers echo. There's a new whiff of gunpowder in the air. U.S. war games sees perils of Israeli strike against Iran. U.S. sees Iran in bids to stir unrest in Afghanistan. Now, what has the United States been doing in Afghanistan since it invaded that country on false pretenses in October of 2001? Has it been stirring unrest? Have there been bombings of wedding parties and mosques? Have innocent civilians been massacred in that country? I don't know. Let's see. Well, you know, what is the record exactly of unrest caused by the U.S.? U.S. defines its demands for new rounds of talks with Iran. This is, again, you know, the emperor speaking to his or her subjects. You must do this a priori. Before we even sit down to negotiate, you must make the following concessions. Then we can have an open discussion. In other words, concede all of my demands before we come to the negotiating table. If you don't, that is will be a signal of your intransigence and your desire for war and conflict with the United States, which only wants, you know, in the tradition of Buddha and Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., peace, and is, a, you know, an advocate of nonviolence. This is called Iran's last chance, incidentally. Right now in Istanbul, the Security Council, the P5, plus Germany and the U.S. And Iran are all now meeting in negotiations. Hawks steering debate on how to take on Iran. Ghosts of Iraq haunting CIA in tackling Iran. These are all front page articles in the last 2 or 3 weeks. The CIA article is very rich in irony, again, totally unintended. Because the embedded question in here is, will the CIA get it right this time? You see, in Iraq, they got it wrong. They couldn't find Mullah Omar. They couldn't find Bin Laden for, you know, over 10 years. But now, will they get it right? That's the important question. And so the whole discussion in the article is about the new documentation that is being used, the new methods of surveillance. Can you imagine if an Iranian drone was downed over the United States or even in Canada, what the response would be? Well, in December, that's exactly what happened. A U.S. drone was downed either by mechanical failure or by military action by Iran for violating its sovereignty, its airspace. Another kind of concept that is unique to Washington because it defines what other people's sovereignty is. So it reserves the right to bomb Pakistan or invade Pakistan on a regular basis, to overfly that country and conduct surveillance. That's perfectly fine. But if anyone does that to the master, then there is a big price to pay. Well, this petition, this actually very colorful flyer, which I picked up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, is urging the Santa Fe City Council not to support any military action against Iran, that diplomacy is always preferable to any kind of military strikes. And Boulder, Colorado, where I live, has already enacted such legislation. Of course, it's entirely symbolic. In the world's second largest democracy, we have demonstrations, we have parades, we march, we protest, and then the government completely ignores us. I'm sure that doesn't happen in Canada, which is a much more vibrant democracy and responsive to the needs of the people in this country. Here's an article, in the New York Times, the Sunday magazine, Israel versus Iran. It's written by a senior Israeli journalist from Yehudit Aronot, a Hebrew newspaper, and he concludes, based on extensive, I'm almost quoting verbatim, conversations he's had with high Israeli political officials as well as military and intelligence officials, that there will be an Israeli attack on Iran. Also, one should mention that five scientists have been assassinated in Iran, and there's some evidence to indicate that a group that is on the State Department's terrorist list the Mujahideen-e Khalq. Sometimes you see that as M-E-K in the press, was engaged by the Israeli intelligence, Mossad, to carry out these assassinations of Iranian scientists. Now, of course, the Iranian government is, you know, not exactly a model or something that we should aspire to. Nevertheless, as a signatory to the IAEA, it has the right to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. The contention of the Israelis and the policymakers in Washington is that they intend to develop, to weaponize the technology and use it for offensive military purposes. Now, this is quite several years away. According to the U.S. Defense Department, its Secretary Leon Panetta, when asked, is Iran developing these weapons? He said, no. That's also the judgment of the National Intelligence Estimate, as well as its director, General Clapper, when asked very directly about that. So we find now once again the wars and the rumors of war in a part of the world, West Asia, which is already, and South Asia, which is already suffering under, you know, enormous burdens of being water stressed, of being ruled in some instances by feudalistic autocratic regimes such as that great upholder of human rights and feminization, the Saudi Kingdom, Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. The best way to think about these, one hesitates to call them even countries, is that they're like family-run businesses, like Walmart or some large, you know, U.S. corporation. I don't know what the equivalent would be here in Canada. Is there some? Is there one?
Walmart.
There is Walmart. And these states, as the great Pakistani intellectual and my dear friend and mentor Iqbal Ahmed described them, the imperialists, the British primarily, and the French to some extent, took flags and gave them to these tribes to make countries. It's curious that all of the states I just mentioned have large quantities of a certain resource that attracts people in Europe and the United States. I will leave it to your imagination. It could be khajur, it could be dates, it could be khorma, it could be figs. I don't know. You know, they have different dried fruits that are very attractive to U.S. Corporations. I think, you know, U.S. foreign policy was defined in 1945 by a State Department document, which has been declassified, which called the oil reserves of the Middle East, and I'm quoting almost verbatim here, a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. That was in 1945. In the very same year, Franklin D. Roosevelt, on February 12th, in the Suez Canal on a U.S. destroyer called the USS Quincy, was meeting with Ibn Saud, the head of the Saudi monarchy. And there, the Faustian bargain was struck between Washington and the regime in Riyadh. The U.S. guaranteed to protect the Saudi monarchy in return for unlimited access to Saudi, that three-letter word, oil, by U.S. corporations. Roosevelt was to die 2 months after that, but that was the key meeting where the deal was sealed, and that has been informing U.S. policy ever since. This is 3 years before the creation of the State of Israel. So it's always been about oil. Israel comes along later as a strategic consideration for U.S. policymakers, but it has consistently been a focus on oil. Now, I want to also mention a little bit about India and Pakistan. There are several brothers and sisters here from South Asia, and I'll try not to exclude people from who are not from that region who, you know, may not know some of the details. So some of this may sound redundant to people here in the audience. I've been going to India since 1966. Studied music, languages, poetry, yada yada yada. Have very close ties with people in that country as well as in Pakistan and Nepal. And I have been in recent years doing quite a bit of work on Kashmir. Kashmir is not just a sweater or fabric. It is a region, two-thirds of which is in India, one-third of which is in Pakistan. And it is part of the unsettled business of partition. And how this came about is very complicated. I don't want to go into the historical nuances. You know, the Maharaja was Hindu. The majority of the people were Muslim. They wanted to opt to join, to accede to Pakistan. The Maharaja comes under pressure from Nehru and the Indian government. A civil war breaks out. The Indian army is sent, and a de facto annexation occurs, with two-thirds being in what is now administered by India, and one-third in Pakistan. Well, since 1989, I'm compressing a lot of historical information here because of shortage of time. Since 1989, a rebellion broke out in Kashmir. Initially, that rebellion was, I would say, uncontroversially armed, instigated, and supported by Pakistan. That was in the early days. Things have changed significantly since then. The Indian Army, already present in the region because of its borders with China and Pakistan, greatly expanded its presence. There are 700,000 security forces from India occupying a very small region. There are about 7 million Kashmiris. So that's one security person for every 7 Kashmiris, or every 10 Kashmiris. It's, for those of you who have not been there, and I was there in February of 11, and I was going to go again in September when I was denied entry into the country, you literally cannot take 10 steps somewhere in Kashmir without seeing Indian military presence, whether it's a barracks, a training site, a checkpoint, a guard tower, barbed wire. It is a highly militarized zone, and the airport itself is a pretty scary place when you come out of it. If you're a foreign visitor, you're immediately separated and asked to fill out separate forms as if you are entering another country, even though you have a valid visa for India. The death toll in Kashmir is around 70,000. 10,000 have gone missing, and this number is very significant because of the unmarked graves that have been uncovered in the last couple of years. There's a terrific group that Gautam Nolaka is involved in, and Dr. Angana Chatterjee, Khurram Pervez, Pervez Imroz, and other human rights activists and academics called the International People's Tribunal on Kashmir. And they have uncovered many of these graves. Others are to be uncovered. And forensic evidence has been gathered, showing quite conclusively that these bodies were tortured. Many of them were executed at close range, gunshot wounds to the head. And it is said with almost certainty that many of those 10,000 missing are in fact in those graves. This has been a huge embarrassment to the land of Gandhi and to the land of Buddha, and the Indian government has been moving heaven and earth to prevent this story from getting out, which is one of the reasons I know I was denied entry, because I was going to follow up on previous work on this issue that I started in earlier in 2011. So what do the Pakistanis, what do the Kashmiris want? Excuse me. Historically, they did want to align with Pakistan. That has changed now. They don't want to be part of India. They don't want to be part of Pakistan either. They want to have their own. They want to exercise their own sovereignty in some kind of independent state. And of course, they're caught between Islamabad and Delhi, both of which are holding on for dear life, and using the Pakistan, using the Kashmiris as kind of hostages in this conflict in that part of the northwestern part of the Indian subcontinent. It's an issue that I think demands attention. I've done a number of radio broadcasts on it. You can go to my website, alternativeradio.org, and see the programs with Angana Chatterjee, with Bina Sarwar, with Khurram Parvez, with Mohammed Junaid, with Arundhati Roy, and others on Kashmir if you want further information on the topic. I think it's always important to know a little bit about, historical background and memory. And I was just in your wonderful independent bookstore here called Spartacus. It's on, is it on Hastings or Maine?
Hastings,
yeah. And I had to go there, quite frankly, in almost a mercenary, mercantile mission, as all the books I brought from the United States with Chomsky and a new book on Occupy the Economy was all sold in Nelson last night and the night before in Spokane, as well as CDs that I had brought along. And so I did manage to pick up a few things here, a book with Tariq Ali, I think that you'll all be very interested in, on South Asia, and a couple of books with Chomsky. But I was particularly thrilled to see that Spartacus had a copy of my early book with Iqbal Ahmed called Terrorism, Theirs and Ours. Now, in the United States, unlike Canada, where history is barely taught, and of course geography, as I mentioned, is almost unknown, and we have a kind of a amnesiac media that contributes to this, so that when something happens, it has no context, it has no chronology, it has no background. It's just wild people, those savages, those crazy Muslims or Arabs or Iraqis or Iranis or Afghanis. Can I mispronounce a few more of them? Yeah, I can try. It's easy to mimic the corporate media. Well, this book with Iqbal Ahmed has a picture of Ronald Reagan, the great American president, with some of the Afghan mujahideen in the Oval Office in Washington, D.C. He called these homicidal maniacs and drug traffickers and feudal warlords freedom fighters, and even compared them to the founding fathers. Now, maybe he knew something about the founding fathers that, has been omitted from American textbooks, U.S. textbooks. But I thought that was a very curious observation. Of course, it was Reagan, first Carter, and his national security advisor, Brzezinski, which lit the fire in Afghanistan by pouring in tens of millions of dollars to start a jihad, to lure the Soviet Union into invading Afghanistan, which they foolishly did, and then training with those great human rights activists in Saudi Arabia and their equivalents in Pakistan, which is now ruled by the tyrannical, autocratic, fanatical jihadist Zia-ul-Haq. Altogether, you had this kind of a potpourri, a mélange of extremism that trained tens of thousands of jihadis, not just from Pakistan and Afghanistan, but from throughout the Islamic world, from Yemen, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, all recruited, paid for, flown to Islamabad. I remember Iqbal Ahmed telling me he saw plane load after plane load of these jihadis disembarking at the airport in Islamabad, and then almost immediately whisked to training camps and madrasas where they learned the fine arts of jihad, reading also textbooks provided by the University of Nebraska, where people learned, many of them were non-Urdu speakers, by the way, that, you know, the letter Jim, that would be J, was for jihad, Kaf would be for Kalashnikov, Bay would be for bomb, and that's how they would learn the Urdu alphabet. It's interesting how these seeds are sown and then forgotten, because the fruits that developed from that jihad, of course, are reverberating in South and West Asia today. But in the U.S., where there is a media that is barely functioning in terms of providing real information to its citizens, all of this is forgotten. There's a term in CIA speak called blowback. Maybe some of you have heard it. It's the unintended consequences of U.S. Foreign policy. So when they train these jihadis, and then the Soviets ultimately leave Afghanistan in January, February of 1989, here you have these people who are trained in explosives, in weaponry, in military tactics, out of work. And so what happens? Almost immediately, a civil war ensues in Afghanistan. The Taliban succeed in winning that particular war, and in 1996 take over the country. The U.S., in fact, under George W. Bush, thought so highly of the Taliban that it gave it tens of millions of dollars in thanks for their eradicating opium production in that country. Opium production, which of course resumed after the U.S. invaded the country along with its NATO lackeys, and is now 90% of the world's opium is produced in Afghanistan once again. So I think historical memory is very, very important in terms of understanding what's going on today. In my hometown newspaper, the Daily Camera, some of us call it the Daily Planet because it's more like Superman's fictitious newspaper. You know, Obama saying attack on Iran, a possibility to go back to Iran. Imagine if Ahmadinejad would announce in Tehran and Kayan or one of the other newspapers there, attack on U.S., a possibility, what the response might be. I mean, there would be mass hysteria. You know, how dare he even threaten the emperor? How dare the servants show any signs of disobedience or disrespect to the great master in Washington? So when the United States announces to the world that it's making the world safe for democracy, I think a better definition would be making the world safe for hypocrisy. Because there's one set of rules for the empire and its servants, and another set of rules for those who do not go along with Washington's diktats. I think imperialism, of course, is very much part of this. I was in Nelson yesterday and picked up my favorite novel and the best single book you could read on imperialism, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, written around 1900. He was witness to Belgium imperialism in the Congo, which was extremely brutal and rapacious and resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in that region. Then it was for ivory. Today it's for oil. It keeps changing the rationales. It used to be gold and silver and ivory and oil. And in the 21st century, according to a World Bank vice president from Malaysia, Ismail Saragelen, he said the wars of the 21st century to come are going to be about water, not about oil. There's parts of West Asia and South Asia, again, where there is all of this turmoil and conflict, which are extremely water-stressed. Conrad wrote, "They were conquerors, and for that you will only want brute force. They grabbed what they could get for the sake of what was to be got. It was just robbery with violence, aggravated murder on a grand scale, and men going at it blind, as is very proper for those who tackle a darkness." See, Africa was thought to have no culture, no civilization. It was the heart of darkness. "The conquest of the earth," Conrad wrote, "which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it," he said, "is the idea." There's some important philosophical concept that legitimizes this, that makes it proper. At that time, in the 1890s, 1880s, 1900, it was the white man's burden. It was inherently incumbent upon the Christian West to deliver the dark-skinned and flatter-nosed people of the East with the great bounties of Western so-called civilization. In French, it was called la mission civilatrice. Today, those terms are not used. They're considered politically incorrect. But when Washington policymakers and the pundits and the media talk about delivering democracy and freedom and human rights, and the latest is responsibility to protect, these are the same kinds of notions to justify intervention, hegemony, oppression, and occupation. So what the U.S. says and what it does is, as they say in Urdu, Zameen Asman Ka Farq. It is the difference between the earth and the sky. That's the extremity of the contradiction between the rhetoric and the actual policy. And I think, again, as Chomsky said in a recent interview I did with him, talking about historical amnesia, he says it's dangerous. Why? Not only because it undermines moral and intellectual integrity, but it also lays the groundwork for crimes that lie ahead. I think it's a very astute observation from Chomsky. And again, to come back to Iran again, because it is on my mind, and I feel it is so urgent because there is, I think, an acute possibility of a war on Iran. You hear often in the U.S., I don't know about Canada, that, the Iranians are ill-equipped for democracy, that they do not have any, predilection toward democracy. But if you look at the historical record, again, which is made obtuse and occluded and excluded, in U.S. textbooks and in the U.S. media, there was a very successful Iranian experiment with democracy in the early 1950s when a liberal Democrat, Mohammad Mossadegh, became prime minister of that country. He, of course, it has to be said, had serious problems. He was a deeply flawed person. First and foremost was that he was educated at the Sorbonne. He spoke French. He had European ideas. This, of course, is in the American discourse, is almost an immediate non-starter. There's something absolute. Because the French, it's café au lait, and croissant, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot, and je ne sais pas quoi. They're not serious people. So, and he was educated in France. So as to demonstrate his lack of understanding for the profundity of the international global order, Mossadegh had this funny idea, obviously hilarious if you think about it, that the natural resources, the oil of Iran, should benefit the Iranian people. Clearly he did not understand the proper order of things. Because at the time, Iranian oil was 100% controlled by a corporation called the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which later became British Petroleum, which later became BP, that, you know, that green company that does such wonders for the environment. They take out full-page ads in the New York Times and other newspapers and magazines and ads on TV showing what they're doing for the environment. I mean, we should all, like, you know, go like this and bow down in front of them from, you know, and thank them for their great dedication to maintaining our environment. And what would we do without BP? Well, 100% of the profits from Iranian oil were being sent right to London. Nothing was staying in the country. So Mossadegh, with all of his flaws, you know, the French education, égalité, fraternité, and the like, nationalizes the oil. So how do the great democracies respond? Do they congratulate Mossadegh? Do they say, you know, right on, brother, this is, you're looking out for your people, you care about them, this is a logical thing to do, why would you want the profits of Iranian oil all being sent to London? And the two great democracies, the UK and the US, organized instead a coup d'etat, which the Americans basically ran, called Operation Ajax, which was run by a distant cousin of Theodore Roosevelt, Kermit Roosevelt, and it succeeded through massive payoffs of Iranian military officers and a huge propaganda campaign to convince the Iranian people that they would have to learn Russian, that Mossadegh was in fact a Soviet agent, that mosques will be closed, that Islam will be banned. You know, the very same tactics that were used in Guatemala in the next year when the U.S. destroyed another democracy, resulting in a considerable bloodbath in that Central American country. And so this propaganda succeeded in Iran. Mossadegh is overthrown, placed under house arrest, and the Shah of Iran, who was in Rome at the time, was put on a CIA plane and flown back to Tehran, where he resumed his position on the peacock throne, where he ruled for the next 26 years as an autocratic dictator with massive, you know, human rights violations, persecutions of Iranian citizens, and all kinds of violations of international law, directly leading to the Islamic Revolution of 1978-79. Again, actions have consequences. If you sow certain seeds, you have to see the fruit that comes out from those seeds, as we see in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, where the U.S. backed Zia-ul-Haq to the hilt, in Egypt, where the United States supported Hosni Mubarak for 30 years of his dictatorship, including kidnapping, human rights violations, rigged elections. I mean, the kind of classic scenario that occurred in Egypt. And Hillary Clinton, during the Tahrir Square uprising, which began on January 25th, 2011, and concluded with the fall of Mubarak on February 11th, in just 3 weeks. During this period, she said, no other country has done more for democracy in Egypt than the United States of America. And I heard this and I was saying, what? And there was the Washington Press Corps, to which she made this announcement, not saying a word, you know, actually fulfilling their role as a press corpse. They're not a press corps. They're actually dead. They're doing stenography. They're not doing journalism. They're not doing any investigative reporting. Those journalists should have just said, shout it out. Are you kidding me, Madam Secretary? I mean, do you think we're all idiots that we don't know U.S. history and what's been going on? Hosni Mubarak was the second longest ruler of Egypt since Ramses II, the pharaoh of Egypt, who ruled for 42 years. And Mubarak ran Egypt for 30 years as a U.S. client, as a U.S. satrap, as a U.S. puppet who signed the peace treaty with Egypt, who condemned the Palestinians to be imprisoned even further in their what is called the world's largest open prison in Gaza. And it was interesting to see the flip-flops of the U.S. media, you know, which again show no signs of shame or even memory. Throughout the Mubarak dictatorship, and this repeats itself over and over again for every U.S.-backed dictator from Ziaul-Haq to Hosni Mubarak to Somoza to Duvalier to Noriega, you name them. You can apply this every single time. If you support Washington policies, no matter what your record is in terms of human rights and social justice within your countries, you are called a moderate, leading a stable country. And throughout this period, Mubarak was called a moderate, and Egypt was called a stable country. All of a sudden, when the revolution occurs in Tahrir Square, you could hear national public radio and the other, you know, media in the United States all of a sudden using words like dictator, autocrat, human rights violator. Now, where did that come from? Did they just discover that between January 25th and February 11th? It's plausible, but it's highly unlikely. And that's the kind of thing you see over and over again. They backed the Shah in Iran right to the end. Then he became a liability. And so he had to be removed. The same thing with the other dictators that I mentioned. In Chile, a democratically elected government of Allende is overthrown. Pinochet is brought into power. Chile is all of a sudden called stable and moderate, and a democratic ally in the Southern Cone. Incidentally, all of those dictatorships in the 1960s and 1970s can be laid at the feet of John F. Kennedy, the great liberal president of the United States, who was assassinated, who engineered the overthrow of the democratically elected government in Brazil in 1964. Johnson carried out the coup, but it was set in motion. It was planned by Kennedy. Incidentally, it was very interesting to note again in the United States how the media function in terms of not providing any information to us, to the citizenry of that country. That is to say, in February of this year, marked the 50th anniversary of Kennedy launching the U.S. Air Force against the people of Vietnam using chemical weapons. Agent Orange, it's euphemistically called a defoliant, but it's a chemical weapon. That's exactly what it is, resulting in high levels of infant mortality as well as various illnesses. That was unremarked upon, uncommented on. Another thing that goes down Orwell's memory hole. Now, the exciting thing that's going on in the U.S. today, of course, is the Occupy movement, and I want to talk a little bit about that. It is the, I think, greatest eruption of democracy in the world's second largest democracy since the 1960s and 1970s. We don't know exactly how it's going to evolve. Clearly, the period of tents and encampments and fixed positions is now over. There's going to be some kind of evolution, and it's very hard to say, to predict how Occupy will evolve. If you go into a meeting, to one of their assemblies, you know, the corporate media goes in, and right away they say, I want to talk to your representative, and 100 hands go up, because everyone is a representative. Everyone has the ability to be heard in these kinds of formations. But I think it represents a hope for democracy in the United States, which is heavily run, unlike Canada, by corporations and their influence on the political process in the U.S. It was interesting. I spent some time in your petrostate here called Alberta. I was in Calgary and Edmonton, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it was 3 weeks ago. Again, I have to look at my date book here to keep the time apart. I think it was three. It was part of Freedom to Read Week in Canada. And I was invited by the public libraries in Calgary and Edmonton to speak there on these issues of media and propaganda and war. Interestingly, I don't get invited by U.S. libraries to speak on the topic. I wonder why. And I had the occasion to interview Andrew Nikiforuk, who is one of your foremost independent journalists, who's written a terrific book called Tar Sands. And I'll be broadcasting this, and you'll be hearing it on Co-op Radio, CFRO, Wednesdays at noon. It's called Tar Sands, Canada's Mordor. For those of you who've read The Lord of the Rings, Mordor is this absolutely hellacious place that you know, where no life exists. Pretty much the geographical description of what's going on in this area around Fort McMurray. One of the positive things that happened in the summer of 2011, actually before the Occupy movement erupted, was 12,000 U.S. citizens circled the White House. 1,000 of them got arrested, all in protest of the Keystone XL pipeline, which TransCanada, one of your wonderful corporations, wants to build from the tar sands in northwestern Alberta out to the Gold Coast through some very sensitive environmental areas, including the largest aquifer in the United States called Oglala. Because of that action, Obama, who was quite ready to okay this deal, backed off and has now put it on hold. What will happen after the November election, if he's elected, is not exactly clear. He has a history of spinelessness and of kowtowing to corporate interests. There's no question that if a Republican is elected, that they will immediately okay that pipeline. And I understand you have an issue here in BC with Enbridge. Is that it? No. The Enbridge pipeline? Again, you know, coming out not to benefit you, but to get the oil out to China. So this is, again, you know, all part of the strategy here of Harperstan, who has never said no to a pipeline or any kind of development to further enhance his corporate sponsors. I'm also interested in the way the media use language, because it's very instructive. And I think if you read Orwell's great essay, The Politics Politics in the English Language, it's, again, like Conrad's book, very, very short. It's the essay itself is like maybe 8 or 9 pages, but it really defines how the passive voice is used, how euphemisms are used, how unclear terms are injected into the vocabulary in order to block understanding, in order to prevent critical thinking, in order to demobilize, to induce a kind of a comatose mental breakdown. And so some of these, you know, words that are used, for example, the U.S. always, I'll just stick to the U.S. because, you know more about Canada. You know, we defend ourselves against evildoers and fierce tribals who carry out ambushes and sneak attacks, or use human shields, they use snipers, they lay booby traps. In other words, they're totally unethical. They have no moral standing whatsoever. We live in neighborhoods, they live in strongholds. We have leaders and governments and administrations, they have hardliners and dictators and regimes. They meddle and interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. The U.S. never does that. Some other examples There are so many examples. International community, peace process. When you hear those terms in the Arab-Palestinian issue, peace process, when the U.S. says that, what does that mean? It's whatever the United States is proposing at any given time. That's the peace process. International community means those countries who go along with Washington. They are, you know, given this sanction of international community, and everyone else is a rogue state, is outside the rule of law. Security Council resolutions do not apply to the master in Washington or its allies in New Delhi or in Tel Aviv or in other satellite states. And of course, you know, India, to go back to India, and I have a little thing here about India. Well, I can't seem to find it. I'm sorry. Too many notes, not enough time. But basically, the U.S. has seen India as capitalism is collapsing in the United States. It is desirous of new markets, particularly in China and in India. Now, the U.S. already has a long-term a hostile relationship with China, and it views it as a future adversary, but it sees the 200 to 300 million Indians, middle class, as a ripe target for economic expansion. And I was in Delhi when Obama came there in the fall of 2010. It was very instructive. He had 200 of the biggest CEOs of U.S. corporations in tow with him, and they were promoting what primarily? Weapons. Billions of dollars of weaponry was sold to India, a country where fully 800 million people are living on less than a dollar a day, and which now has malnutrition levels in excess of all of sub-Saharan Africa combined. So is that what the Indian people need? Do they need more weapons, or do they need more food and humanitarian aid? I don't know. I guess you can have a debate about that in the media. Because as large numbers of Americans, U.S. people have become pauperized, capitalism must expand to generate profits. This is classic, what is called dollar diplomacy. Break into the Indian economy, dangle some carrots like support for a Security Council seat, new weaponry, joint military training exercises. The United States conducts more military exercises with India than any other country. Bring in Israel, which is a major player in India and in the Indian military establishment, because Israel has shown it knows how to deal with Muslims and the right-wing Hindu tendencies in India are, of course, very admiring of the Israelis and how they deal with the Palestinians and Arabs in general. So the U.S. is dangling all of these carrots, including puffing up New Delhi's ego with talk of a strategic alliance. And you could see Manmohan Singh, the prime minister, almost, you know, swooning when he hears these kinds of, you know, carrots being thrown to him. And part of that agreement now between Washington and New Delhi is Washington says nothing about Kashmir, absolutely nothing. Even though massive human rights violations are going on. Look at the high dudgeon they went in about Libya over, and of course, totally inexcusable, several hundred Libyans were killed. That's sometimes, you know, the death toll in Kashmir in a week or in a month. No comment about that. So you see the very selective use of human rights, of international law. It's whatever pleases the master. That's what gets discussed. The media go along with that in the U.S. and, you know, in and among some of its allies as well. Iraq has been wrecked by the United States. It is now, you know, the U.S. should not only apologize to the Iraqi people, it should offer reparations to them for the enormous damage done in that war. The same thing in Afghanistan, and, you know, Pakistan is in an extremely parlous situation. Its economy is basically non-functioning. You have an elite that live in unbelievable wealth and villas behind, you know, in these gated communities, many of them owned by the Pakistani military, which is a major real estate player in Pakistan, as the Egyptian military is a major real estate player in Egypt. It's interesting. I think those two militaries have sort of been cooperating, and I understand that the Revolutionary Guard in Iran has also become a major economic factor in the Iranian economy, with domestic factories and housing projects and the like. Is that fairly accurate? I'm checking with my Iranian informant in the audience. So I want to, there's a lot more to say. I could, you know, literally go on and on. United States of Amnesia. It's a huge article in the New York Times just last week about Chile and Camila Vallejo. Camila Vallejo is a 23-year-old Chilean student activist who has been leading the kind of Occupy movement in that country. And in the fourth paragraph, we see that the 17-year dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet, who in 1973 overthrew Latin America's first democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. All of that is true, except there's one important fact omitted, that coup and overthrow of the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was engineered in Washington. It could not have happened without Washington approval, without Washington financing. We have the documents. Nixon told the CIA director, Richard Helms, to make the Chilean economy scream. No matter what the cost, he said, I don't care what it costs, we have to bring down the Allende regime. Why? Because he could be a threat of a good example. Other countries could learn from Allende, from Chile. And that has always been an operative motif of U.S. foreign policy. That's why democracies are destroyed in various countries, including Brazil and Guatemala, and the list goes on and on. And we see today, you know, again, the U.S. working with the Gilani Zardari regime in Islamabad, hardly an example of a democracy, yet nevertheless, you know, funding, enabling it to continue in power. Just a couple of other things. One is, I had a whole bunch of CDs that, for me, it's good that they all sold, but I so much wanted to bring them here to this audience to share with you, and it was, and I'll tell you what they are. It's a set of five CDs. Let's see if I can remember them. One is with Bina Sarwar, who's an independent Pakistani journalist on Pakistan. These have all been recorded in the last couple of months. Another one features Angana Chatterjee on Kashmir, Buried Evidence. She is a North American, she's a U.S. academic from Bengal who lost her job recently in California. And her husband, Richard, was also denied entry into India. Angana is very, as I mentioned earlier, is very prominent on the International People's Tribunal on Kashmir. And so when she shows up at the airport, they can't deny her entry because she's an Indian national, but they turned away her husband, Richard. So it's not just me. There are other people being denied entry. Two Danish journalists were recently denied entry into India. So, you know, all of these things are going on. So Angana Chatterjee, that's another one on Kashmir. Then Maud Barlow, this wonderful Canadian Council of Canadians, who's talking about the water issue, not a drop to drink. Maud Barlow, I've done a number of programs with her, and then a two-part program with Noam Chomsky on unconventional wisdom. So these are five CDs that I will, if you pay me today, I hate to make this sound like a business deal here, but Sunset was unable to pay my $100,000 speaking fee. They tried, but they couldn't quite come up with the, you know, capital. So I have to generate some money through the sale of books, and you saw that sheet that was going around, Occupy the Economy. That's available. If you give me 30 loonies, now I will mail you these five CDs. If you were to order them from Boulder, where I'm based, it would cost around $80 or $90. So it's the bargain for this particular event. Excuse me for being, commercial to that extent. And I do have just a couple of books that I'd, you know, love to share with you, and a new book with Chomsky. I'd like to close with two South Asian voices, if you'll permit me. One is Faiz Ahmed Faiz, the greatest Urdu poet of this era. He died in 1984. He was born in Sialkot in Punjab. He was a journalist. He was jailed by Zia-ul-Haq. Even Bhutto put him in jail, if memory serves correctly. And he was a Red. Yeah, he was a communist and proud to be one. And his poem called Bowl, for those of you who are not familiar with South Asian languages, has kind of become an anthem at demonstrations that I attended in Karachi and Islamabad and in Lahore, and even in India as well, because bowl is used in Hindi as well as Urdu. It means speak. It's the imperative, speak. So this is read, and there are huge posters everywhere. You know, it's either in Devanagari or in Urdu that says, Bol, speak. Bol ke lab azad hai tere, bol zuban ab tak teri hai. Speak, your lips are free. Speak, your tongue is still yours. Speak, there is little time, but little though it is enough time. Enough before the body perishes, before the tongue atrophies. Speak, the truth still lives. Say what you have to say. Speak, your lips are still free. Faiz Ahmed Faiz, bold. And finally, the words of my dear friend Arundhati Roy, who is not only an extraordinary novelist, the God of Small Things, but I think one of the most brilliant political essayists anywhere in the world, writing today about the depredations of the corporate state in India and its collusion with the central government in stealing land, in expropriating resources such as manganese and iron ore in Jharkhand, in Chhattisgarh, in Madhya Pradesh, in other areas of India where there's a huge uprising against these kinds of activities that Roy has lent her very eloquent and articulate voice in support of. It's, again, like Kashmir, a very underreported story about what's going on in the Indian countryside. You have all of these resources that primarily Indian corporations, but not just Indian corporations. In the state of Orissa right now, there's a South Korean corporation, POSCO, P-O-S-C-O, that is launching the biggest investment project in India, a $12 billion steel plant. And the people there, who are mostly Adivasis, that is to say indigenous, don't want any part of it. They don't want this plant there. They don't want their mountains destroyed. They don't want a secret, a port being exclusively built for this South Korean company in order to ship out the manganese and the iron ore to Japan and to China and to South Korea. So there's a huge fight going on in the state of Orissa as well. So Roy is, of course, because she is a tall poppy, as she once told me, it's very dangerous to be a tall poppy. When you stick out too much, then people can find you to be an easy target. And she's been, you know, she's received many death threats. She's meetings where she speaks are routinely disrupted. Her home was attacked in Jorbagh, in New Delhi, last year. So I worry about her. But her voice continues to be heard, and I think she's a model to emulate in terms of integrity and fortitude and commitment to human rights and justice. Maybe Barack Obama, who never deserved his Nobel Prize, should turn it over to Arundhati Roy. Now that would be a righteous thing. And while he's doing it, maybe share it with Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, people who are being prosecuted and persecuted for disseminating the truth through WikiLeaks and other, you know, these government documents. But that's not likely to happen. But it's interesting that you found that to be something that excited you. It should happen. If we lived in a just society in the United States, those kinds of things would be ordinary. Instead, they're considered a utopian, another term of abuse. This is what Arundhati Roy wrote 10 years ago. I'm going to stress that. 2002, in a speech she gave in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Fortunately, power has a shelf life. When the time comes, maybe this mighty empire will, like others before it, overreach itself and implode from within. It looks as though structural cracks have already appeared. America's corporate heart is hemorrhaging. For all the endless empty chatter about democracy, the world is run today by three secretive institutions: the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, all of them dominated by the United States. The people who head them are appointed behind closed doors. Nobody really knows anything about them, their beliefs, or their intentions. Nobody elected them. A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected cannot possibly last. Soviet-style communism failed. American-style market capitalism will fail also. The time has come, the walrus said. Perhaps things will get worse and then better. Perhaps there's a small god up in heaven readying herself for us. It's really interesting. I read millions of things and poetry, and whenever I read this phrase, I choke up. I don't know what it is, but it haunts me, and I have difficulty getting through it. I think it's because of the hope that it embodies. Another world is not only possible. She's on her way. Maybe many of us won't be here to greet her, but on a quiet day, if I listen very carefully, I can hear her breathing. Thank you very much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.